support for the process, saying it was no longer possible with Mugabe at the helm. Tutu also called again for removing Mugabe by force if he refused to step down, and warned Mugabe and his cronies could be charged with crimes against humanity. Charlene Hunter-Galt, NPR News, Johannesburg.
Every year, Britain's Channel 4 broadcasts a greeting designed to be a counterpoint to Queen Elizabeth's traditional Christmas message. It was once delivered by the cartoon character Marge Simpson. This year will be by Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. According to a transcript, Ahmadinejad said that if Jesus were alive today, he would oppose warmongers, occupiers, terrorists, and bullies the world over, an apparent reference to the U.S. and its allies. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Universal Pictures, presenting Frost Nixon, based on a confrontation that changed history, now playing in select theaters everywhere December 25th.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from CarX Auto Services, locally owned and operated, offering complete auto and tire repair services at their three Champaign locations at 901 East University, 906 West Bradley, and 2216 South Neal, open 6 days a week.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. When you think of the Founding Fathers, there are certain names that will immediately come to mind, like George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton. One, though, who is often overlooked, and I think that some people would say unjustly overlooked, is Samuel Adams. He was the cousin of John Adams, the better-known Adams, but he was someone, that is, Sam Adams, was someone who was very highly regarded by his peers in his time. In fact, his cousin John said this, "Without the character of Samuel Adams, the true history of the American Revolution can never be written." He was among the first to call for independence from England. He helped plan the Boston Tea Party. He was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He was a pivotal swing vote in ratifying the Constitution. And we'll talk this morning about Samuel Adams, about his contribution to early America, the American Revolution, and perhaps why it is that he is not as well known as he should be. And our guest for the program this morning is Ira Stahl. He is vice president and managing editor of the New York Sun, which he helped to found. And he is the author of a new biography, Samuel Adams, A Life. It's published by the Free Press. You can find it now in the bookstore, or perhaps at the library if you'd like to read it. Just a little bit more about our guest. He has been a consultant to the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. He was an editor of the Jerusalem Post, managing editor and Washington correspondent of the Forward, editor of SmarterTimes.com, and also a reporter for the LA Times. And he is joining us by telephone. Mr. Stahl, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
The
obvious first question when you read about Samuel Adams and his contributions here, the obvious first question is why it is that he is I don't want to say exactly forgotten, but his name is not going to be one of those that's going to come right to mind when you ask people, okay, start naming off some of the people who were important at this period of time. Why do you think it is that he and his contributions have been overlooked?
Well, I speculate about several answers to that in my book. The first and sort of most simply and practically is that he didn't leave that much of a paper trail. A lot of his letters ended with the words, "Burn this," and we know that because at least one of the recipients disobeyed the instruction. He was very concerned that his letters would fall into the hands of the enemy during wartime and be a breach in the security of the revolutionary cause. So his collected correspondence fills only about four volumes, whereas George Washington fills about 30. So historians have had a bit of a hard time getting a grip on Samuel Adams. Another reason is that he's one of the more religious of our founding fathers, And I think the secular trend in American universities and public schools has worked to his disadvantage. And the third reason is that he was actually a revolutionary. And I think Americans in the last century saw revolutionaries as negative figures like Lenin or Castro or Mao, forgetting in some ways that our country was founded by our own revolutionaries. Hmm.
You think it was the case that his commitment to the idea of revolution was somehow more deep or greater than the other people that we think of, his cousin or Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, John Hancock, all of these other people?
Well, there are certain moments where Samuel Adams took a harder line, certainly, or didn't give up. There's a moment from 1770 to 1772 where John Adams sort of had a nervous breakdown and said, "Well, I've really got to stop dabbling in politics, and I've got to go back to leave Boston and go back to Quincy and focus on my law practice." And he did. He really took 2 years off there while Samuel Adams kept on writing newspaper article after newspaper article, giving speeches, writing letters to friends in distant colonies, and really trying to keep up the pressure on this cause. There's another moment at sort of the beginning of the First Continental Congress where Benjamin Franklin is based in London and trying to cut a deal and saying, "Well, maybe if the people of Boston would just pay back the cost of the tea they dumped into the harbor, maybe, we could kind of paper this over and compromise and, let bygones be bygones." Samuel Adams, by that point, was very clear that, this breach was not going to be healed. So, at least in comparison to those other founding fathers, there are certainly moments where Samuel Adams was more persistent or more clear-eyed. Mm.
You were talking about the fact that he was a strongly religious man. Certainly he came from a strongly religious family, and there might have been a time when he contemplated or perhaps did contemplate becoming a clergyman himself. He went to Harvard, and of his class, the class that entered, a lot of them actually did go on to become ministers. Was this something that he at one time thought seriously about?
Well, because of that lack of a paper trail, it's sort of hard to tell. The family history is that his mother sort of wanted him to become a clergyman. And, Samuel Adams' father was a church deacon. The closest he got, really, he had some cousins who were ministers, and he married the daughter of a minister who he had a very close relationship with, I think, actually, the minister in his final years of life or months of life actually moved into Samuel Adams' home.
He went to Harvard when he was 14 years old, is that
right?
Right. And to study there. Can you see in what he was interested in, what he studied, what he did, anything that is left, that you can see this revolutionary fervor that we talked about starting to germinate even as young as when he was, say, either in his late teens or maybe in his early 20s?
Well, we know that he went back to Harvard for his master's degree at age 21, and it was for arguing yes to the question whether it be lawful to resist the supreme magistrate if the Commonwealth cannot otherwise be preserved. So he was talking about resisting the authorities to preserve the Commonwealth, even at age 21. Also, at Harvard, we know that he studied Hebrew, and one of the things I've been interested in is the way that Samuel Adams identified with the story of the ancient Israelites fleeing Egypt, fleeing slavery, he thought that the Americans were on a similar journey, and he thought that God was on their side.
This you mentioned here at that point in the book where you're talking about his career at Harvard, where he took up this question. And you point out that was 33 years before the Declaration of Independence. So this was early on when he was thinking about these fundamental issues. And I also, you mentioned here also a quote from his cousin John. John Adams wrote to his wife. He writes, "I pity Mr. Sam Adams, for he was born a rebel."
Yeah, I mean, the quote says something about John Adams as well as about Samuel Adams, doesn't it? Some of us might not pity someone for being born a rebel. Some of us might admire someone for being born a rebel. I think it's a very insightful comment.
Yeah. So, but that it sort of starts you thinking about what it was about either his character or his upbringing, the family he lived in, anything else that he was exposed to, that at such an early age got him thinking about these things and ready to take that kind of position right at that point, so long before the revolution, that would argue for American independence. I don't know exactly how he would have expressed it or what he would have expressed it, but clearly he was on that track pretty early on in his life.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of things we know about his early life. I mean, for one thing, he had a family that had seen a lot of adversity. He was one of only three children of the 12 that were born to his mother that survived till adulthood. And we also know that his father was involved in forming a land bank in Boston, a kind of early version of real estate bubble that went bad. And that ended badly when the British-backed authorities moved against it. And the sheriff of Boston, after Samuel Adams' father died, actually tried to seize his father's house and take the money away from Samuel Adams. And Samuel Adams resisted that with newspaper ads appealing to the public and managed to fight off this effort by the sheriff to seize his father's house.
This you mentioned the fact that he came from this family where his parents had a lot of kids, few of them lived to adulthood, and I guess I was really struck by that and moved to think about how common that was at the time. And in fact, Adams and his first wife had a number of children, and only I think.
They had six, and only two of them lived to adulthood, and one of those even died before Samuel Adams did. So, and even on top of that, Samuel Adams' wife, then in giving birth to the sixth child, died shortly thereafter. So, and she herself was one of only three of 12 to have survived. So, even by the standards of the time, which was high infant mortality, Samuel Adams' family and his first wife's family really suffered. And I think the fact that he maintained his religious faith in the face of such loss, and the fact that he actually managed to keep going, he remarried, he poured himself into public activities. I think it might have been either a way of dealing with his grief or just a sign that he was able to withstand tremendous adversity. And I think that those character attributes served him well later during the Revolutionary War when he was under threat of death.
That's another interesting point, I guess, and worth making, because it underscores his role. And something that I think people should appreciate, and that's just this little factoid that at one point the top British general in America, Thomas Gage, at one point he offered a blanket amnesty to all revolutionaries who would lay down their arms, except two. There were two people that it did not apply to. John Hancock was one of them. Samuel Adams was the other. So if the British had caught him, they would have strung him up.
That's right. And it sort of cuts both ways. I mean, on the one hand, people who wanted to minimize the widespread support for the revolution would portray it as something that, oh, it's just Samuel Adams's propaganda and there was no real substance behind it. But I think there is some truth to the fact that Samuel Adams was an important leader of the revolution, and that, you know, without him, things might have turned out differently.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Ira Stahl. He is the author of a recently published biography of Samuel Adams, the title Samuel Adams, A Life. It's published by the Free Press. Our guest is Vice President, Managing Editor of the New York Sun, which he helped found. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and if you certainly have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just so we can get it out on the table for those people who think about Samuel Adams as being a brand of beer. In his early life, he actually did have some professional connection to the brewing business, although I don't think he actually was a brewer himself, but he had a business where he was he supplied one of the major components to people who did make beer.
Right. There's a lively controversy among historians over whether Samuel Adams was a brewer or just a maltster. Somebody who sells malt. And I actually investigated this with the founder of the Boston Beer Company, which sells Samuel Adams beer, and he tells me he was offered for sale a receipt for hops, which was supposedly signed by Samuel Adams. And hops is an ingredient in beer that wouldn't go into other malt beverages. I should disclose that the beer company is sponsoring a beer tasting after an appearance I'm doing in New York next week. So, my interest is disclosed. I would say that Samuel Adams, some people have asked me if Samuel Adams would be insulted or sad to see his name just, you know, known for beer. I think he would have wanted his other accomplishments to be known as well. On the other hand, Samuel Adams did have a feel for the common person, and he was among the most egalitarian of the founding fathers, and I think he might have been horrified to see his name on $1,000 bottle of imported red wine, but to see his name on a bottle of beer, I think might have made him happy.
Probably be okay. All right, I don't know that he in his life was ever particularly successful as a business person, or seemed to have a mind that really inclined itself that way.
He was terrible at business, and he admitted as much. He wrote to his wife, "I glory in poverty," and she wrote back, "I'm short of cash." She was not the first wife of either a journalist or a politician to make that complaint.
And he was one that never throughout his lifetime was particularly ever well-to-do or made a lot of money off of anything that he did.
That's right. When he went to Philadelphia for the first Continental Congress, the people of Boston actually took up a collection to buy him a suit of clothes, because none of his existing clothing was adequate to the importance of the trip.
We have a caller. Let's talk with them. Someone who is listening in Urbana, I believe. Yes, line number one. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Stahl.
Good morning.
In an earlier biography covering the Boston area, this is by Eva LaPlante, a biography of Samuel Sewall, she described an oligarchy in early Boston. Now, by the time of Samuel Adams, growing up, was there anything left of that oligarchy in which the leaders of commerce, of government, and of the religious leaders were all intermarried families?
Well, that's an excellent question. I do get into some of the marriage and kinship ties in my book. They existed both on the side of the revolutionaries and on the side of the more loyalist factions. So you have the fact that John Adams and Samuel Adams are cousins. You have the fact that Samuel Adams was related by marriage to the family of Cotton Mather, who was and Increase Mather, who were presidents of Harvard, important preachers in early Boston, authors, and they actually led their own uprising against a British-appointed governor a century earlier.
That was related in the biography. Yes.
Yeah.
So the seeds of opposition to a formal British rule were around, and it certainly appealed to Samuel Adams. Would you say he was on a par with Patrick Henry in Virginia?
There are a lot of similarities with Patrick Henry. I think that Patrick Henry ended up not voting to ratify the federal constitution,
yes.
However, and Samuel Adams, well, he was very much on the fence about it and wished that there were more amendments to protect freedom of religion and freedom of speech, the sort of amendments, the freedom from search and seizure, the sort of amendments that eventually became part of the Bill of Rights. Samuel Adams ended up voting to ratify.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. He fairly early on, we talked about his involvement in business and not being particularly successful. One thing that he also started to do fairly early on was to write and to write about politics. How was it that he started out in a sense being a political journalist or a political commentator?
Well, the newspapers in Boston at the time were quite important. They were an important way of communicating. There was no radio, television, or internet, so people got their news from newspapers. And these newspapers, they were mostly weeklies, and they tended to fail and start up again or merge with great frequency, and the people who operated them often had printing businesses as well. So they would print books and broadsheets and also own and edit newspapers at the same time. So he started writing as early as we know as the 1750s for one newspaper, and then he really became active in the 1760s, writing mainly for a newspaper called the Boston Gazette.
He got involved early on in perhaps the beginnings of his opposition to the British government had to do with their tax policies. And particularly, as you write in the book, that the thing that first got him exercised was something called the Sugar Act. What was the Sugar Act?
Well, the Sugar Act was a tax, an effort to collect a tax on sugar, and that the whole trade in sugar and molasses was a very important part of the colonial economy, and that, remember, it wasn't just the what we now think of America, but all the islands down in the Caribbean, and then the stuff went back and forth to London, and the real nub of it was that the taxes weren't created by the people who were being taxed, the people in Massachusetts or Boston. They were being set by people in London and by the king to pay off war debts of England. And, people nowadays who are involved in the tax debate say, well, was Samuel Adams for high taxes or for low taxes? What would he think now about whether to raise taxes? And I say, well, it's a little bit of a different thing because, in America we decide, we vote and we choose our own taxes. The objection was to the lack of representation as much as to the level of taxation.
And he was among the first, really, to make that point and to try to organize around that, or at least get people talking about it.
Absolutely, and that was really one of his main contributions. And it's ironic because he actually made his living for a part of this time as a tax collector, and he was collecting taxes for the town of Boston, not these customs duties imposed by the British. And he was. At that time, the tax collectors actually kept a percentage of the taxes they collected personally, so that was a way to make a living if you had no other way to make a living. And Samuel Adams was really bad at that job, so much so that he got in a little bit of trouble over it. But, you know, he saw that people actually had difficulty coming up with the money to pay these taxes, and he was a bit generous in granting people forgiveness on it. Mm.
We are at our midpoint here. I guess I just want to very quickly introduce again the guest, Ira Stoll. He's a journalist. He's a vice president, managing editor of the New York Sun. He's also been consultant to the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, editor of the Jerusalem Post, managing editor and Washington correspondent of the Forward, editor of SmarterTimes.com, reporter for the LA Times, and is the author of a recently published biography of Samuel Adams, the title Samuel Adams, A Life. That's published by the Free Press. You want to read it, you can head out to the bookstore and look for the book here in Champaign-Urbana. If you'd like to call in, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think also one of the things that distinguishes Samuel Adams perhaps from others is that in addition to writing and organizing and speaking, he was a guy who favored direct action. Let's talk here about the Boston Tea Party. I think probably people have some vague idea about what actually happened here. He was one of the instigators. He, I guess, did not personally participate, but was one of the people behind this event. How did he come to be involved in this?
Well, at this point, he was already a leader of elected leader of Boston. He was active in the town meeting. He was elected by Boston to represent it in the Massachusetts House of Representatives. And when the tea arrived with this tax imposed by Parliament in London and the King that most of the people of Boston objected to, the people of Boston convened in this sort of unofficial group that they called the Body, and it was thousands of people. At first, it met at Faneuil Hall, and it spilled over, and it met at Old South Meeting House, the church, and the Body kept sending Samuel Adams and a few of his colleagues back and forth to negotiate with the British-appointed governor, Thomas Hutchinson, with the tea consignees, as they were called, the merchants who had ordered the tea. And when those negotiations failed, there was a big meeting, and there was a demand to return the tea to Boston. Then that failed. Samuel Adams stood up and announced, "This meeting can do nothing more to save the country." And that was the signal for the commencement of the Boston Tea Party. Everybody rushed off and changed into their Indian costumes and dumped the tea into the harbor. Some people have asked, well, was that an act of violent vandalism or even terrorism, some have suggested. To me, it's interesting that Samuel Adams was quite proud that it was only the tea that was dumped into the harbor and destroyed. It's not as if the ships were burned. It's not as if the owners of the ships or the sailors who manned the ships were dumped into the harbor or killed or tarred and feathered. It was a destruction of property, but it was a very limited and targeted destruction of property. And he made sure to emphasize that in his letters to people elsewhere in the colonies and London and in his newspaper writing.
Well, this is an event. I guess I'm not really sure how people think about this now. The question is, I guess, just how important at the time was this? And was it really a very significant gesture by the Americans? And was this something that caused the British government to be very concerned?
Well, one thing that was important is the way the British reacted to it. If the British had reacted by saying, "Ooh, well, this tea tax is trouble. We might as well just drop it, and you know what? Well, don't worry about the tea. You know, we've got plenty more tea over here in London. You know, let's just take it easy for a while and let things blow over." Well, maybe things might have been different, but in fact, they reacted quite harshly and passed a series of measures called the Intolerable Acts that went as far as closing down all of Boston Harbor, which was sort of an act of collective punishment. And that really got the rest of the colonies quite riled up and got the rest of the people of Boston quite riled up. And, you know, even though some more, I guess you'd call them moderate colonists like Benjamin Franklin were aiming for some sort of compromise where the people of Boston would pay back the tea company for the cost of the destroyed tea, and there'd be a reconciliation. The issue of the tea tax and the issue of whether the people of Boston would pay back the amount of money for the destroyed tea, that festered for years and really, I think, was a contributing cause in the revolutionary conflict. Because once the soldiers were in there in Boston, a clash became almost inevitable.
So that I guess that serves as an illustration of the role that Adams played as an agitator.
Yeah, I think it's fair to call him an agitator. You know, I think it's not as if he could have, if there was no real underlying grievance, I don't think he could have caused a revolution. In fact, there's a moment after the revolution where George Washington, who was then president, and John Adams, who was then his vice president, were visiting Boston, and Samuel Adams rode out of the town to greet them, and the three of them marched into the city on horseback, and an onlooker said, "Oh, there go three men who could start a revolution whenever they wanted to." And somebody wrote later that, I think it actually might have been John Adams, wrote later that he hoped it wasn't so. In fact, I think that's true. These men were revolutionaries, but they had a real substantive grievance. I mean, the laws were being made by England without the consent of the governed, without the consent of the colonists. And after the revolution, when that had changed, at least for white men, it changed. You know, even somebody with a revolutionary personality like Samuel Adams became much less of a revolutionary. And in fact, when people of Western Massachusetts started to rebel against the taxes that had been imposed by the constitutionally elected government of Massachusetts, Samuel Adams advised taking quite a hard line against those tax rebels in what became known as Shays Rebellion.
Mm. Well, though, would it be correct to say that there would have been at the time would have been people who would have argued that if they could just work out a more equitable kind of relationship with the British, and to particularly deal with these kinds of tax issues, that they wouldn't necessarily have had to break with Britain. It sounds as if he would, though, have been on the other side that said no. He would argue for the idea of independence, and not just that if we sort of solved these other problems or made it so the taxes weren't as bad, that would have been okay.
Well, you know, I think he may have had some openness to the idea of some compromise early on, but he figured out quite quickly and earlier than some of the other revolutionaries that it would be quite unworkable. I mean, one of the compromises that was suggested would be that the colonies would elect some of their own representatives to Parliament. And some people actually, you know, really put that forward as a serious idea. But Samuel Adams' counterargument to that would be that the colonial representatives in Parliament would definitely be a minority, so they could always be outvoted. And in addition, the great distance between the colonies and London would have made it difficult for these representatives to really communicate with the people they were representing in such a way as to have timely input on, you know, voting decisions.
We talked a little bit ago about Adams as agitator. I do want to step back in time at least a little bit into something we kind of skipped over and have you talk a little bit about the Boston Massacre. And apparently the reason we call it the Boston Massacre is Samuel Adams. He was the guy who called this event the Boston Massacre. Maybe now it's still a little bit unclear exactly what happened. What is the story on the Boston Massacre?
Well, the British had troops in Boston. It was a snowy, icy night. There were some clashes at a rope walk, which was a large area where people twisted string into ropes that were then used on the ships, actually, one of the colonists supposedly said to a soldier, "Are you looking for extra work?" And the soldier, who would have been allowed to take on work in a rope walk to earn some extra money on the side, said, "Sure." And the colonist, you know, flung a commode at him and said, "You know, clean this out." And the soldier kind of stalked off and said, "Well, there's going to be trouble later." And, you know, it's very hard to tell. There was a trial over it, actually, who threw the first snowball or threw the first stick or threw the first insult, and when the order to fire was given, or whether the first shot went off without an order and then only later there was an order to fire. What's definitely clear is that it ended with several of the colonists dead. The British officer and soldiers were taken custody of and put on trial in Boston. John Adams was actually a lawyer defending the British officer, and Samuel Adams played a pivotal role in the trial, wearing lots of different hats. He gave advice to the prosecutor on trial strategy. We have a copy of this notes that Samuel Adams sent to the prosecutor on how to best make the case. He covered the trial for the newspapers in exhausting detail. It was almost like the O.J. Simpson trial of the day, in which every week Samuel Adams wrote another several thousand words dissecting the testimony of that week's witness and saying, "Well, I believe this witness more than the other witness because this witness is, you know, has stronger character." And by the end of it, it was almost 30,000 words Samuel Adams wrote on the Boston Massacre trial. He begged his readers' forgiveness for having taken up so much space on the topic. And then in addition to writing about the trial and giving the prosecutor advice, Samuel Adams actually visited the judge before the trial with one or two colleagues in what we would now think of as something that was highly irregular and perhaps improper. And, you know, they claimed they were just asking for a speedy trial, which the British were trying to avoid because they didn't want to be caught up in the passion immediately after the event. Oh, and finally, a third thing I should say is that Samuel Adams helped organize these elaborate funerals for the Boston Massacre victims, and that was really a element of political theater, right up there with today's political conventions, where there were these parades and songs and elaborate displays, so that, you know, everybody really knew what had happened and publicly mourn the lives of these victims.
And as you mentioned, John Adams, Sam Adams' cousin, John Adams, was was the defense lawyer for the British who were charged with having fired on the Americans. He said, and apparently there must have been other people who thought that there was deliberate provocation by the colonists against the British. That is, they were trying to pick a fight to see if they something like this could, you know, they were it was intentional. It wasn't an accident.
Well, they may have been trying to pick a fight, but there's a difference between yelling insults and throwing a snowball and you know, being shot. I don't think they were hoping to be shot to death. Certainly Samuel Adams didn't see it that way.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, we're talking with Ira Stahl. He's the author of a recently published biography of Samuel Adams. The title is Samuel Adams, A Life. And it's published by the Free Press. Questions welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free 800-333-WILL or 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. What was the role of Samuel Adams in the Continental Congress?
He was a member of the Continental Congress for 7 years. He served mostly in Philadelphia, but at times, when Philadelphia was occupied by the British, the Congress met at Baltimore or at Lancaster and York, Pennsylvania. And he was very active on the various committees. He seconded the nomination of George Washington as Commander-in-Chief. He was the one who, at the first meeting, proposed that an opening prayer be given by a minister of the Church of England. And that was a little bit controversial because the Congregationalists in Boston had a lot of hostility towards the Church of England. In fact, many of their ancestors had fled England because they wanted to run their own churches and they didn't like the way the Church of England was running things. So the idea that Samuel Adams proposed that this Philadelphia Anglican clergyman give the opening prayer at the Continental Congress was seen as a sign to the more to the colonies where the Church of England was stronger, especially, you know, Virginia and some of the other southern colonies, that the new nation, which was, you know, not yet declared or didn't yet have a constitution, but that it would be open to religious pluralism.
I did mention right at the beginning of the program that certainly he was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. Did he have a particularly strong role in helping that document come to be?
Well, he was one of the earliest in arguing that there should be a Declaration of Independence. And to those who opposed it, he said, well, we're already independent. And he felt that it would put America on a stronger position when it negotiated with Britain for an eventual peace, to be negotiating as a independent country formally rather than as, you know, just a rump province. You know, I think if you go back and look at some of Samuel Adams' writings, he wrote a document called a Declaration of the Rights of the Colonists as Men, as Christians, and as British Subjects. And there's language in there about the rights of life and liberty that you see repeated in the Declaration of Independence.
One of the things I think is interesting, in thinking about the fact that there would be war, figured that the colonists were going to need all the friends they could get, and advocated trying to bring in the Indians, Native Americans, into the war on the side of the colonists. Was that something that was controversial at the time?
Well, there was a controversy with it was a part of a broader controversy over who was capable of freedom and self-government. And, you know, Indians were part of it, women were part of it, African Americans were part of it, and, you know, everyone other than white male Europeans were part of it. And Samuel Adams was pretty progressive for his time on all those fronts. with, and there was a correspondence he had with his cousin John Adams, who, after having served as a diplomat in Europe, had a more aristocratic sensibility. And Samuel Adams wrote, you know, I believe that even savages are capable of freedom and self-government, and, you know, with the appropriate education, of course. And so he also spoke out against the slave trade. He wrote that it was odious and abhorrent, and, you know, that those were he also admitted women into public education in Boston for the first time when he was governor of Massachusetts and as a committee member of the Boston town meeting. So, you know, there are other areas where Samuel Adams was less progressive. He was quite bigoted, for instance, against Catholics. But even there, he reconciled himself to the American alliance with France, which was led by a Catholic king. So, you know, the Indians are just one area where I think Samuel Adams had a very open-minded view of who was capable of freedom and self-government.
Did he, aside from, you know, speaking out against slavery, I mean, did he take that any farther than that?
Well, there's a couple of interesting anecdotes about that. One is that the family lore is that he was actually offered a slave as a gift and turned it down. I found in the Pennsylvania Historical Society a certificate of freedom for a slave that was signed by Samuel Adams and said, you know, I know that the bearer of this document is of good character and is a free man. And Samuel Adams was instrumental in drafting and winning passage of the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, which almost immediately after it was passed, judges used to formally abolish slavery in Massachusetts. And even before that, actually, when Massachusetts was still under British rule and Samuel Adams was a member of the Massachusetts House, he was the person that the slaves of Massachusetts directed their appeal to freedom for, and the Massachusetts House actually passed a law banning the slave trade, but it was never signed into law by the British-appointed governor at the time. Hmm.
He continued to, after the Revolution, to be involved in politics. He ran unsuccessfully. He ran for Congress, that is, to be a member of the U.S. House, mm-hmm. but continued to be involved in politics in his home state.
That's right. Both at the convention to ratify the Constitution, he was president of the Massachusetts State Senate. Then he was lieutenant governor, and then for 3 years served as governor of Massachusetts after the death of John Hancock.
So was he somebody that, though in other ways, had important impact on American politics there in those early years?
Well, there was a controversy during those early years, really, between advocates of a strong and powerful central government and those who believe more in individual rights and the focus on government at the state level. And that caused a rift between the two cousins. John Adams was more of the strong central government, what we became known as the Federalists, and Samuel Adams sided more with the Jeffersonians. And when Jefferson became elected president, he wrote to Samuel Adams after his inaugural address, thanking him for a lot of the language and ideas that he had used in his inaugural address. So that, you know, that's one way. And, you know, another way is, I think as we approach Thanksgiving, I think it's fair to credit Samuel Adams with the first National American Thanksgiving holiday, which he helped pass, and as a member of the Continental Congress in 1777, and again in 1778, and then as governor of Massachusetts, he passed so many Thanksgiving holiday declarations that one of his political enemies said, it would be an occasion for a real day of Thanksgiving when Samuel Adams finally retired.
Well, that's an interesting story, this first Thanksgiving. This was at a time when things were looking very, very bad for the Americans in their fight against the British, and that then they got a piece of good news, a significant American victory, and he said, well, we ought to mark this and acknowledge this and celebrate this.
That's right. I sort of begin my book with this story, and the British controlled both New York City and Philadelphia. The congressman had fled at 3 a.m. from Philadelphia after Alexander Hamilton had rushed in saying the enemy was so close that it had shot his horse. Some of the congressmen even left their extra clothes behind in Philadelphia. They left in such a rush. And you know, all of a sudden, after they fled to York, a messenger rushed in from the Battle of Saratoga. It was a huge American victory. It really got the French prepared to join the alliance with America, which was the turning factor in the military outcome of the war. And, you know, that was a point where Samuel Adams and his ally from Virginia, Richard Henry Lee, were put on a committee, and they came back with this resolution really thanking God for the victory and for the blessings of freedom. And it was part of the reason, I think, that they were willing to fight on in the revolutionary cause under the threat of death, is that they actually believed that God was on their side. Critics accused Samuel Adams of wearing what they called a religious mask, and you know, thought it was just propaganda. But the fact that we know that after Samuel Adams retired as governor, he went to church regularly on Sunday and sat with the choir and sang, and his private correspondence telling relatives how important religion was and writing things like, oh, I wish we were a more religious people, suggests to me that it was really a deeply held and personal faith, and that Thanksgiving was a way for him to make it into a public expression of faith. Hmm.
So it's, going back to the point where we started, your hope is that now perhaps people will reacquaint themselves with this man and appreciate his contributions?
Well, I'm hoping they do that through my book. And I think, you know, particularly not only at Thanksgiving, but, you know, at a time where, given the financial markets, a lot of us are poorer than we were a few years ago, Samuel Adams was someone who took pride in being poor and realized that there were certain things like faith and family and freedom that are more important than money. I think he has a lot to say to us today.
All right. Well, if folks would like to learn more about this man we've been talking about, you can look for the book that I mentioned here a couple of times, Samuel Adams, A Life, published by the Free Press, by our guest, Ira Stoll. He is the president, vice president, managing editor of the New York Sun, which he helped found. And Mr. Stoll, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and many local news features, are available on our website anytime that you are ready to listen. Just go to WILL, that's will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Brighten your Christmas Eve afternoon with the moving, insightful, surprising, and sometimes even life-changing stories in this year's Third Coast Festival. The best new documentaries produced worldwide are featured, along with producer interviews and highlights from the annual awards ceremony. Gwen Maxey is your host for the Third Coast Festival this afternoon from 1 to 3 here on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from RE/MAX Realty Associates. RE/MAX Realty Associates are full-time agents with an average of 13 years professional experience listing and selling homes. Information at 352-5700. RE/MAX encourages you to join them in supporting public broadcasting.
I'm Peter Sagal. Saturday on the Best of Public Radio 2008, The Power of Music to Heal.
I love you, love
She would sing Mayor'sy Dotes and Dozy Dotes to me, like, pretty much every time I talked to her on the phone. And then we'd sing it together.
Join me and Fred Child for the Best of Public Radio 2008 and your chance to help make great radio in 2009.
Saturday from 9 to noon and again from 1 to 4.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Trophy Time in Champaign, with plaques and promotional products to recognize all occasions from athletic endeavors and musical moments to business achievements. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. Additional information available on the web at trophytime.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
Some rain, drizzle, and snow, but little or no accumulation.